Stone. Wanna see my picture on the cover. Stone. Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother. Yeah. Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Continuing to read from the April 2025 edition of Rolling Stone, Random Notes. Cinderella Story, How Model and Actress Learned to Let Go and Have Some Fun. An avant-garde Brooklyn band dips daringly into pop on its second album. If you saw one of the 100-plus shows that Model Actress played in 2023, what you were probably most struck by was the Brooklyn Noise Band's intensity. Every night felt somewhere between a secret initiation and a car crash, with lead singer Cole Hayden at the center of the madness. "It's not a show unless we're all drenched in a sweat," says Hayden, age 28. Those shows were never less than exhilarating for the audience, but by last year, the band was starting to feel exhausted. "Playing shows every day fried the reward center of my brain," says drummer Ruben Radler, age 29. "I didn't know how to make the shows feel good anymore unless it was constantly leveling up. And usually the only way is just to play harder." Guitarist Jack Wetmore, age 29, winces as he remembers one European tour where he played so hard that he ended up injuring himself on stage. "I had gotten into a habit of throwing equipment," Wetmore says, "and then that shit hurt my back." Bass player Aaron Shapiro, age 30, smiles thinly. "I don't think I've ever felt less sympathy for a person in pain than a man who threw a guitar at himself." Model Actress can laugh about that era of the band now because they're all about to vault past it. Their second album, Pirouette, out April 25th via True Panther, is a stunning sequel to their rave review debut, Dog's Body. If Hayden's lifelong love of pop stars like Lady Gaga and Kylie Minogue was something the last album hinted at, it's front page news on this one. Radler calls Pirouette a dance pop album, and while you won't confuse it with anything in the top 40, there's a new energy that's irresistible. On lead single Cinderella, Hayden recounts how he dreamed of having a Cinderella-themed birthday party in elementary school, only to change his mind out of fear. "That's my experience as a gay youth," he says. "I remember wanting to wear the dress, and I was imagining entering the party, and then I remember thinking about what other people would think of me." In the music video, he gets his moment at the ball after all, starring as Cinderella in a surreal storyline that climaxes at an underground club. Radler, Wetmore, and Shapiro play Cinderella's mean stepfamily. "Despite all the pain, I still made it through to the other side," Hayden says, "and I don't have to defend myself like I did. I can let the shield down." Some of Barrett's most thrilling peaks come on songs like Vespers, where Hayden lets us listen in on his inner monologue before a show, and Diva, where he fully embraces his power as a charismatic performer. "Yeah, you could call me a small business owner living in America while trapped in the body of an operatic diva." The playful quality in his words mirrors the band's newly flexible studio philosophy. Recording over a few weeks in Rhode Island last fall, they found that their sound has room for an acoustic ballad, the song Acid Rain, and a spoken word ambient interlude, the song Headlights, along with plenty of sleek twists on the industrial clangor they're known for. "A lot of it was asking ourselves, what is the point of all this honestly?" Wetmore says. "The world was falling to shit in so many different ways, and we're out here trying to write fucking songs." They found a surprisingly liberating answer in letting go of any expectation of how a Model Actress album should sound. "All we can do now is have fun," Radler says. Continuing with Random Notes, Code Red, The Limits of TikTok Activism. The cute winter boots trend shows that being part of the hashtag resistance
is about more than hashtags. Cute winter boots. Where to find cute winter boots? In the weeks following Donald Trump's return to the Oval Office, the phrase dominated for you pages on TikTok. But this wasn't about footwear. The term was an algorithm-based code TikTokers were using to avoid alleged censorship. The president's vow to keep TikTok active in the United States has come with a wave of concern online that the app is actively suppressing any videos it deems anti-Trump. TikTok did not respond to a request for comment. That's how the cute winter boots trend was born. Early iterations referred to a heightened fears of ice raids because winter boots keep you from slipping on ice, warning people to watch out for immigration officers in cities like New York and Los Angeles. Then it meant take a stand against all Trump-era immigration policies. Then the meaning became even broader, keep an eye out for fascism. And ultimately, it simply became a dog whistle meant to attract like-minded liberal posters on TikTok. Vox's Rebecca Jennings recently wrote about an erosion of trust between social media users and platform owners like Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg, one that makes people suspicious of platforms even when operators say they're not censoring content. But as a cute winter boots trend evolved away from its original context, it highlighted how an algorithmic trend that is purposely vague can fail to make a difference at a critical time. Sarah Austin, a 23-year-old Amazon driver in Florida, posted at least two cute winter boot videos, both of which featured handwritten messages urging her 500,000-plus followers to look up proposed bills targeting America's immigrant population. She started using the format because her TikToks criticizing Trump would get views only in the four-digit range when she previously hit 10,000 even on her lowest-performing posts. "The main thing for me is to get people informed and pressure them to do their own research," she says. "There is always going to be a faction of people that say it's performative, but I'm not trying to profit off of this." In the first week the boots hashtag emerged, it was used on 37,000 TikTok videos. But August were among the few with a real call to action. Some people posted cute winter boots videos with no message at all. Only soundtracks from resistance-focused movies like The Hunger Games, Cabaret, and Les Miserables. This isn't the first time online communities have attempted to use code words to organize. In 2020, the hashtag Blackout Tuesday, Day of Silence on Instagram, when supporters were encouraged to post a black box, clogged relevant hashtags and made it nearly impossible for organizers to share information on protests. The concern around cute winter boots trend was that users might think posting is enough. Hundreds of users have complained that the trend is nothing more than a way for people to virtual signal. Christine Tran, a digital culture expert and assistant professor at the University of Toronto, posits that today's creator economy is incompatible with real-world action, stating, "These platforms encourage people to aggregate attention, aggregate time, jump on trends. I take creators' earnestness in this moment seriously, but I don't think developing these vernaculars is a way out." If the goal of censorship is the control of information or ideas, then an anti-censorship trend that intentionally obfuscates its own message isn't clear. It misses the point. Platforms' material interests are at odds with the loftier goals of leftist organizing, Tran says. "You're performing for imagined audiences and algorithms, but people under attack by ICE don't have to contend with imagined detractors. They're contending with police, and I don't know if we can meme our way out of this." Continuing in random notes, Selena Gomez and Benny Blanco. This was unlike any other process. The two stars aren't rushing wedding plans. They have an album to release first. An interview. If the engagement ring Benny Blanco slipped onto Selena Gomez's finger in December has sealed his fate as a stay-at-home husband, he considers it to be a pretty good deal. That's what I'm praying for, the producer and songwriter, age 37, says over Zoom from their Los Angeles residence. I like to be domestic. Gomez, age 32, is seated to his right, smiling down at the massive marquee diamond beaming back at her. She can't complain either. When she's craving chips and queso in the dead of the night, he's down in the kitchen making it happen. And when she's hunkered down in their home recording studio, unsure of her musical direction after a few false starts in the 5 years since her LP Rare, Blanco helped clear the fog. "That's the most intimate I've ever been in a studio," says Gomez, who dropped her fourth studio album, a release with Blanco titled I Said I Loved You First, in March. "We did everything from home, and we created it with people that we love. Having familiar corroborators Julia Michaels and Justin Tranter on the project, along with Blanco, unlocked a sense of freedom in the singer and actress. And while I Said I Love You First has taken slight precedence over wedding planning, Gomez and Blanco see the record as an extension of their relationship. I haven't seen her excited about music for a long time," Blanco says. "I was like, well, if it's making both of us happy, then hopefully it makes a few other people happy." Now the interview. Question: what did album mob feel like for you guys? Gomez: I was, to be honest, very frustrated, kind of confused on where I wanted to go next musically. And we had been together for a while, and obviously I would confide in him. I couldn't figure out my sound. It helps that he knows a little bit about music, and it's kind of happened organically to where I felt like this process was unlike any other process I've been through. Blanco: she'd wake up. I have a pen out, and I'd write what was on her mind. Then we'd go into the other room and create it, and it became a song. It was such a choreographic and a therapeutic experience. All the songwriting, it's all our friends. There's no like, man, we're going to get in with this person for the first time. I wonder how this is going to go. We also kept this one really close to the chest because I feel like it was so important for it to be written exactly how we wanted it and to feel exactly how we wanted it to feel. Question: the album title, I Said I Love You First, feels like a middle finger to the people who have had so much to say about your relationship. Tell me why you choose to call it that. Gomez: it's just factual. It just is actually what went down, and it describes this. This whole project embodies his stories combined with my stories. They have meanings that are really just personal to both of us. So one song could actually mean two different things, and I think it was just really cute. I think it was probably your idea, but yeah, guilty as charged. I said, I love you first. Blanco: she did. I'm just happy to be along for the ride. I'll tell you that much. I'm happy. Put me in, coach. I'm doing whatever it takes. Question: Selena, how did your approach to emotional ballads change after having a career-defining moment with Lose You to Love Me? Gomez: I think it's to say my strength in music would be just storytelling and the way that I just feel comfortable in a lower register and a softer tone. That's something that I know I can bring to the table, so I just tried to highlight that. And so did Benny, while he was composing everything and putting it together. It was like, what would be nice and soothing for my voice? Nothing that sounded like I was trying to be something else. That was really important to me. To do these vulnerable songs, it's nice, because I'm in a different place than I was. Question: you kept your relationship incredibly private for the first 6 months. Were there moments when you considered going public but decided against it? Blanco: I definitely tried to keep it private for a while because it's a lot. I remember us having a conversation about whether we're going to keep dating or not. We just had to make sure, because she's as big as it gets, and it's a big undertaking. It's not like you date someone for a few weeks, and then you're like, oh, okay, bye. So we just took it slow. Then it started becoming such a hard thing, because it was like, I don't want just to have dinner inside with you and have all of our dates inside, and we're wearing a mask the entire date. And then we have to go hide in a car. I was so sure that I was going to marry her. I just knew. It's just a very different feeling. I knew when Sel wakes up, she's thinking in her head, how can I make this day as good as I can for Benny? And I know I'm waking up saying, how can I make this day as good for Sel? We're just thinking about each other. Question: how soon after the engagement does the full-blown wedding planning start? Blanco: I think every day she's planned a new wedding in her head. We're very much like take it one day at a time type of people. We're still not over this moment. Literally, while you were talking, she was sitting there staring at her diamond ring. Gomez: also, I generally feel like this is such a special time that we get to apply it to this album and really just pour our heart into it and completely translate what we feel and bring it into the world. That's my main focus right now, at least. Question: Benny, you post so much food content on TikTok. And Selena, you have Selena plus Chef. What role has food and cooking in particular played in your relationship? Blanco: I always know what she wants. I can feel it. But then every once in a while, there'll be something so random. I remember she never said this ever. And then she was like, I want a donut. And I was like, I've never even heard you talk about a donut. It's fun. And you get to put it into your work, too. When she's recording vocals, I like to go downstairs and make tea. Make little snacks. Bring them up. Gomez: I don't really cook. I'm incredibly timid. And I just am also intimidated by his skills. I know people might just see this stuff, but his food is really good. It's kind of my love language, and he happens to make the most delicious things. Blanco: she's a great cook. Just like everything else in her life, she tries to downplay it. But I do love cooking her breakfast every day. These are the moments we get to have with each other, because we're both so busy, we're both doing so many things. It's amazing to be able to sit down for 30 minutes and just have a meal that I cooked, or we cooked, or she cooked, and just be able to sit there and talk about nothing and just melt into the experience. Question: what does a house sound like on a chill night in, or when you're having some friends over? Blanco: I'll be playing the best shit. I'll be playing Philly Soul Era, or playing Luther Vandross. I'll be playing Charles Mingus or John Coltrane. And she always tries to steal it. If I'm in the bathroom or I go away, she tries to get on. But no, me and Sel both love oldies. We went away the other day, and we got to take a bath and listen to Ella Fitzgerald. Gomez: and it depends. When we have friends over, we'll do cooking nights, and we'll play music depending on the food. Sometimes. I'm also just like, I love my main pop girls. I have to put on those rotation. Question: what's your favorite thing about each other? Blanco: her heart and the way she treats everybody. Her best friend she treats the same way as someone she's holding the door open for or walking down the street. She has one of the kindest hearts I've ever met in my entire life. Okay, I'm done. You better say something good. Gomez: I was like, damn it, I should have gone first. But generally, I think he's incredibly kind. He's supportive. He's uplifting. He's very smart. I love picking his brain about everything. He's one of my best friends, if not my best. Blanco: better be. Turning now to the future of music. Meet the artists who have us most excited about the music of tomorrow, now. Featuring Benson Boone. He's 22 years old. He had the biggest song in the world last year, and the future looks even brighter inside the heart mind of a rising star. When Benson Boone is about to jump out of a helicopter hovering 60 feet above Utah Lake, which is the kind of thing Benson Boone likes to do, a single thought passes through his molded 22-year-old head. This is going to be sick. On clear days, that very body of water, and the white mountains beyond it are part of the panoramic view from the terrace of Boone's house, a sharp-angled, industrial-gray luxury fortress with towering windows atop a cliff 30 minutes south of Salt Lake City. "It's always good to try things in life," Boone says one early January afternoon, peering out from the terrace at the distant lake and the endless azure sky, his hands shoved in the pockets of an unseemingly light canvas jacket. "Like adventure-wise, if I can just try everything once, then I'll know what I like and what I don't like, and I know that I like jumping out of a helicopter." Beautiful Things, the song that paid for his house, the most streamed track in the world last year, the national anthem of baby and puppy Instagram reels, finds Boone singing about an almost existential terror, begging God not to take away what he loves. "But most of the time," he says, "I'm not much of a fearful guy. Like, I don't worry about many things." He doesn't worry about backflipping off pianos on stage, even if insurance companies might not love it. He doesn't hesitate to try out for American Idol in 2020 as a teenager who had only been singing seriously for a year, a hobby, he says, that came out of nowhere but took a hold of me very quickly. "They're going to swoon over Benson Boone," predicted one of the judges, a precipitous Katy Perry. He wasn't scared to drop out of the competition's top 24 in 21, vanishing from the show in the middle of the season after he decided it would hinder rather than help a real music career. "My biggest weakness and sometimes my biggest strength," he says, "is when I convince my brain of something. I have to do it. There's no backing out or stepping down." He just had his first full week off in 3 years, which was all that brain of his required to recharge and reboot. Tonight, for the third night in a row, he'll head out to snowboard with his girlfriend, the effervescent influencer Maggie Thurman, who's currently hanging out upstairs. "I'm ready for this year," he says, deeply breathing. "I'm so rested, and my mind is so clear, it's unbelievable." He had smaller scale viral songs beforehand, but Beautiful Things made him a star, and it's the kind of uncontrollably huge hit that threatens to overshadow even the artist who recorded it. "I mean, it's the reason I'm here," Boone says. "Like, it's the reason this year has been a big year." He still performs it with seemingly fresh passion, not that he has a choice, given the way it pushes to the Freddie Mercury-ish top of his considerable vocal range. It's not really a song you can half-ass, you know. But he's finishing up a new album, tentatively titled American Heart, set for spring or summer, and he's more than ready to move beyond his hit. "I think I'm getting to the point where I just want people to know that there's more than just that song," he says. "I think I'm a little past that point. But of course, I still love the song, I'm still proud of it, and I'll be performing it for a while, so I hope that feeling sticks around." Until that album drops, he only has 24 or so released songs total. So he's already been slipping in stuff from the new album into his concerts, mostly because he's dying for up-tempo material to match his onstage athleticism. Beautiful Things began as two in-the-works songs jammed together, so it disguises itself as a ballad in its verses before bursting into full-on rock crescendos. The "please stay" bit in the chorus even bears an odd resemblance to the "hey wait" chorus of Nirvana's Heart-Shaped Box. The song's ubiquity underscores 2020's pop starling but decisive turn towards guitars and relatively live-sounding instrumentation, from Olivia Rodrigo to Teddy Swims. And on his new album, Boone is trying to pick up where that energy left off. "A lot of it," he says, "is very Bruce Springsteen, Americana, has a little more of a retro vibe." He doesn't know if he has another world-conquering single this time, but that's not necessarily a point. "It all started with me believing in the song Beautiful Things. Now I have a whole album just about ready to go, and I never believed so much in a body of work." He still mostly writes at a baby grand piano that belonged to his late great-grandmother, which sits in a sunny corner room of his house. His initial songwriting on that instrument reflected a strong Adele and Sam Smith influence, heavy on soulful ballads, including In the Stars, a track mourning the piano's original owner. "When I started, that's kind of what felt the most comfortable to me," he says. "Now that I'm finding how I like to perform and how I want other people to see me, I have so much energy on stage that it is so hard to come with a set of slow songs. It killed me at the beginning because I was like, I want to be doing something cool, but I'm like sitting at this piano singing a song about my dead grandma. It was tough." His fan base leans young and female, and he's learned the art of eliciting screams. But the heartthrob thing makes him a little uncomfortable. "I definitely remember there was a time where I'd take my shirt off because I didn't know what else to do," he says. "After a lot of shows, you start to pick up on what people like and don't like, what girls like and don't like. There's an art to making anybody go crazy. I also don't want people to come to a show expecting me just to take my shirt off and it to be like a gun show. One, I don't have the guns for that. Two, that's just not what I'm about. I don't want to rely on my physical form to be the primary driver of my shows." Some of his discomfort, he acknowledges, comes from profound self-consciousness. He's been working out hard the past few months, and his refrigerator is full of strawberry vanilla protein shakes. "It sucks to just focus on that all the time," he says, his voice softer, "because I'm so incredibly hard on myself. And when I start to think about my appearance too much, it just kills me because there's always something more I could do. There's always a hairstyle, or like my arms could be bigger, my shoulders could be bigger. It's never ending. I can't afford to think that way, because I'll never be happy if I do think that way." "Some people wrongly assume that these issues don't affect male celebrities," I tell him, thinking of the more serious bodily image struggles Ed Sheeran shared with me not long ago, or the way D'Angelo recoiled at the demands to take his own shirt off on stage. "Dude, it affects me so much," Boone replies. "Obviously, like, I enjoy working out. I want to keep my physical shape because I need to. But I can't be the sex icon of the century just because that's not who I am. I'm just going to drive around," Boone says, steering his SUV around the sleepy development surrounding his house. "We're not going to go anywhere." We've jumped into the car to play some of his new album, which he wrote with one of his Beautiful Things collaborators, Jack LaFrance, over the course of 17 days. He starts with "Young American Heart," a surging, killers-ish song about a near-fatal car accident he got into with his lifelong best friend as a teenager. The verses: "If I'm going to die a young American, and this was the final night we'd ever have again, I'd be just fine as long as I'm wherever you are." To get closer to performance mode in the studio, Boone prefers as few encumbrances as possible, so he tends to whip his shirt off, LaFrance confirms later. "Nothing, even clothing, messes up the vocals," says LaFrance, who's become a close friend of Boone's. He even had a mustache before him and thinks he may have inspired the look on Boone. "I will not confirm or deny whether pants are also on or not." In any case, Boone and LaFrance did their best to pretend the pressure of following up Beautiful Things didn't exist. "The studio is kind of a sacred spot," LaFrance says. "We always kind of want to keep it feeling like this and not change it because of success or anything else. We tried not to overthink it." Boone plays "Mr. Electric Blue," an ELO-like song about hero-worshipping his dad, a square-jawed dude who works in computers and can still do backflips of his own in his early 50s. "He's a man's man," he sings, "a good, hard-working American, but he ain't the guy you want to fight." The next verse of the next song, "The Man and Me," not to be confused with the Dylan song, is synthier and dancier and seems to be about a relationship less happy than the one he's currently in. The verse: "You took the man in me, you took his sanity." There's a ballad about missing his mom too, called the Mama Song. The one Boone thinks will end up being biggest is called Mystical Magical, a quirky 70s vibe pop song with a hooky R&B bass line where he pushes his voice so high in the chorus that he compares it to Tiny Tim's Tiptoe Through the Tulips, a reference I wasn't expecting. Another favorite is I Want to Be the One You Call, an energetic pop song with a surging chorus. It's a mutated version of an earlier near-abandoned track Boone didn't care for at all, with the final version developing in a session with frequent Frank Ocean collaborator Malay. It was so quickly just one of my favorite songs I've ever made, Boone says. I was so shocked, and it came out of nowhere, because the song before was truly, like, so bad. I think it was the first one we made for the album. So that kind of kicked it off. I got really motivated to make more songs after that that were of the level to me. Boone was a pop fan well before he was a singer. Growing up in rural Monroe, Washington, he was an athletic outdoor kid who didn't even have a cell phone until his late teens. He and his four sisters would clean the kitchen every night to a Pandora playlist based off of Hooked on a Feeling, which tended to yield hits by Springsteen, Stevie Wonder, Michael Jackson, and Queen. A very incredible era of music, says Boone. And he had his own musical obsessions. I always loved Justin Bieber and One Direction, he says. I mean, I was too embarrassed to admit it to my friends. Did it come to him through his sisters? He shakes his head a little sheepishly. Honestly, I was probably a bigger fan of them than any of my sisters. He and his friend Eric, the one from the Young American Heart car accident, would watch their videos for hours, especially One Direction, says Boone. We thought being in a boy band was like the coolest thing ever. And this is before I even knew I could sing. I just thought they were so cool. Thinking of hundreds of girls chasing us was probably like the coolest thing ever. But again, you know, would never tell anybody. He recalls watching Bieber's Never Say Never documentary with Eric, his friend, at home, only to rapidly switch off when one of his sisters came home. But in his own life as a pop star, he tends to bristle at comparisons. I don't want to be the same as Harry Styles, he says, and the same as Freddie Mercury, and the same as Justin Bieber, and the same as One Direction, like, because it's not me. I'm Benson Boone. I'm completely different. In addition to the whole biggest song in the world thing, Boone achieved another major distinction last year because of one of the only male opening acts on Taylor Swift's Eras Tour and a June show at London's Wembley Stadium. I didn't even know that much about her, Boone says. Her team reached out, and I literally, like, shit in my pants. I could not believe it. It was so insane. So I started listening to more of her music. I didn't want to go to that show and not know anything. He came away transformed. She is an unbelievable performer and has an unbelievable world built around her that is unmatched, Boone says. It is incredible to see how vastly gigantic her show is. Just countless moving parts behind the scenes that nobody knows about. She is one of a kind, such a genuine person. I got the privilege to talk to her for a while, and she's so kind. And she shouted me out on stage, which you do not need to do. It really changed my perspective on many things that I want to carry into my own career. Just the way I treat people and my crew, watching the way that she treats people. There's a lot of people who don't like Taylor Swift. Everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but if you have something against her and you don't know her, I don't think that's fair. At its hidden core, Beautiful Things is a prayer from a young man in the process of losing the faith of his fathers. Boone grew up in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and his family was devout. My faith drives everything that I do and my perspective of what life is about, his mom told a local newspaper in a 2017 story about his family's extensive volunteer work. To me, there is nothing more important than strengthening my family and serving other people. That's what brings joy. But currently, Boone says, pacing around his kitchen, I don't want to be part of one religion. I have my own opinions. Some are from this religion, some are from that religion, and some are from no religion. The break came quietly and early. Growing up, a lot of people at church would talk about these experiences that they've had and these personal revelations and feelings and voices. I never felt it as physically present as they did, and so I was always confused and frustrated. I was always scared to bring that up to people because I just didn't want to accept that. Like, I wasn't feeling what everybody else was feeling. He eventually admitted it to a friend who replied, "Thank goodness, I feel the same way." Before dropping out to pursue music, Boone spent a missed semester at Brigham Young University, but it was during COVID, so he had no experience of its various on-campus rules, the dress code, the prohibitions on sex, beards, and cursing. He's grateful that his feelings about his faith haven't affected his relationship with his parents. "My parents definitely have their own views, but when it comes to religion and God, they want me to figure it out on my own way," he says. "And whatever I come to and whatever I feel is right, that's what they want for me." Boone compares his religious uncertainty to politics, another subject he's not super eager to get into detail. "People think if you have one or two views that are on the left or right side, that you have to be the left or on the right. And I don't think that's how it is." He does want to make it clear that calling his album American Heart isn't meant to drag him into any cultural wars. "It's not political at all," he says. "It's more of a personal thing. It's just me. American Heart is my heart, and it's not my heart because it's American. It's my heart because I'm Benson Boone." Turning to Rolling Stone's National Affairs section. Smash and grab. Trump's shockingly lawless second term. More strategic and more prepared to engage in corruption. Donald Trump and Elon Musk are blindly purging the government to make it more MAGA and cruel, ignoring the law and cashing in like America has never seen. There are less than 4 days to go until Donald Trump was sworn into office for a second time. In those final days of the presidential transition, Trump and his team were busy finalizing their blitz of executive actions, which included a widespread crackdown on civil rights, trans Americans, and diversity programs. Trump's government in waiting was putting the finishing touches on plans for a startling navidist propaganda campaign, which would soon feature an ASMR video of officials preparing to fly migrants to camps at Guantanamo Bay. Trump had preemptively allocated an astounding amount of power to the world's richest man, Elon Musk, giving him near free rein to desecrate the federal workforce. And the president-elect was giddy about one of his more depraved opening acts still to come: the mass pardons and commutations for his supporters who stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Amid all of this, the incoming president had something else on his mind: his meme coin. The Friday night before his inauguration, Trump announced he was launching his own cryptocurrency called Trump Meme, a purely speculative asset comparable to a digital baseball card with no inherent value or use. The price of money sign Trump quickly blew up, surging from around $6 to $74, generating billions of dollars on paper for the Trump family. The launch was so successful that First Lady Melania Trump quickly raced her own meme coin out the door too, less than 24 hours before Trump's inauguration, a move that caused dollar sign Trump to begin crashing. By late February, the coin was trading at around $13. The earliest investors likely made huge profits. Hundreds of thousands of suckers appear to have lost big. The Trump family will make a killing no matter what. By early February, his family and their partners had made nearly $100 million on trading fees. In the final days of the transition, and even during his early presidency, Trump privately encouraged close allies in big business and on Capitol Hill to buy his meme coin, according to a source familiar with the matter and one Republican lawmaker. He would even do it over dinner. "You should really get into it," Trump would bluntly recommend. "Of course he did," the GOP lawmaker recounts. "He told the whole country to do it via an X post. So why wouldn't he tell the people he knows? There's nothing wrong with that." The lawmaker refused to say whether they invested, though if they bought any Trump coin more than an hour or two after it launched, they would have lost big. The meme coin was a blatant cash grab to the point that one of Trump's former White House communication directors denounced it as an Idi Amin-level corruption. It wasn't even the Trump family's first foray into crypto. During the 2024 campaign, his family announced the creation of their own cryptocurrency platform, World Liberty Financial. As he promised on the campaign trail, Trump has worked aggressively to push the crypto industry's interests in Washington and ensure the incredibly risky assets operate with little regulation, signing an executive order to promote crypto, announcing a crypto strategic reserve, and naming an industry ally to lead the Securities and Exchange Commission. At the end of February, Trump's SEC moved to throw out its prosecution of Justin Sun, who had been charged with marketing unregistered crypto securities and manipulating the market for a crypto token, after Sun's investments in World Liberty Financial reportedly netted the Trump family $56 million in fees. The crypto caper is a perfect encapsulation of the bold-faced graft at the heart of the new Trump presidency. Uber-wealthy elites are poised to cash in, while ordinary people get hosed. And public policy will be designed to encourage this exact outcome. Compared to other major corruption scandals since the 1870s, this administration is shaping up to be the most corrupt of them all, because never before has a president been willing and able to blatantly use the office to make massive personal profit, says Kedrick Payne, the Campaign Legal Center's general counsel and senior director for ethics. Compared to his first term, he's more strategic and more prepared to engage in corruption, and he's taken big steps to wipe out any possible enforcement against his actions. An example of this is his financial interest in crypto, while at the same time shaping the policy to allow the very industry to flourish. Payne adds, "The blatant nature of this is generally new, when I think a lot of people have trouble wrapping their heads around. Normal corruption involves lobbyists providing gifts and perks and campaign contributions to lawmakers in hope they will receive beneficial legislation. These are acts that directly benefit Trump's bottom line." The Trump administration did not respond to requests for comment. While still in its infancy, Trump's second administration has been a shocking expression of corruption, lawlessness, and cruelty, with an even higher level of chaos than Americans had grown to expect from the former game show host. It's clear now his critics were correct about what a Trump win would mean. If anything, many of them undersold the threat he would pose. At the center of the horror show is Elon Musk, who spent $290 million boosting Trump and Republicans in the last election cycle. In return, Musk was put in charge of Trump's so-called Department of Government Efficiency, known as DOGE, D-O-G-E. Trump and Musk have used this not-so-legitimate office to blitz through constitutional checks and balances and longstanding federal laws in order to consolidate and expand presidential power so they can dismantle whole agencies and purge the workforce to make it more MAGA. With Musk and his team of young far-right helpers at DOGE leading the way, the Trump administration has moved to fire tens of thousands of federal employees with no basis at all, ranging from the vast majority of workers at the U.S. Agency for International Development, America's Foreign Aid Bureau, some healthcare workers at the Department of Veteran Affairs, staffers who take care of our great national parks, and employees at the Federal Aviation Administration who keep the skies safe. They've also fired hundreds of staffers at the agency that manages America's nuclear weapons before attempting to hire them back. Veterans make up 30% of the federal workforce, so Americans who served our country are all but assured to absorb the brunt of Trump and Musk's mass firings. Moreover, Musk and DOGE specifically sought to cancel hundreds of Veterans Affairs contracts that would eviscerate the department's ability to provide promised care and benefits, according to Washington Technology, a magazine for government contractors. Most of the contracts targeted were held by service-disabled veteran-owned small businesses. Congress estimates 50,000 veterans will lose jobs, homes, and more, says Michael Imbrich, a former policy advisor to the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, adding, "Those who swore to defend democracy will now have their pursuit of happiness stripped by two of the richest and most powerful men ever to skirt serving in the public interest." In a short time, the ethical quandaries of Trump's first term have begun to look comparatively small. Outside of the crypto space, there are so many different ways for businesses or foreign interests to put money directly in the coffers of the president and his family. During the campaign last year, Trump privately discussed jacking up the price for membership at his private club and estate, Mar-a-Lago, because members are paying to see the president. After Trump's defeat of Vice President Kamala Harris, top CEOs and corporate executives amped up their visits to the president's Palm Beach club, with Amazon's Jeff Bezos, Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, suits from the pharmaceutical industry, and many others making a show of kissing the ring. Senior staff at lobbying outfits and a variety of corporate giants immediately began planning retreats, galas, and annual meetings at Mar-a-Lago and other Trump-branded golf resorts and event spaces so they could shovel cash to Trump. One longtime D.C. lobbyist referred to these payments as tips for the president. Wired separately reports that Trump's super PAC has charged $1 million per seat at Mar-a-Lago events with the president. One-on-one meetings cost $5 million. Even the First Lady has been making deals, including an outlandish agreement with Amazon. The company signed a $40 million deal with Melania Trump for a documentary film that, as one Amazon source puts it, nobody asked for. Other studios, to the extent that they were interested, reportedly offered far lower sums. It's expected that most of the money will go directly to Melania. She personally pitched Bezos, Amazon's founder and executive chairman, about the film project, directed by disgraced filmmaker Brett Ratner, over dinner at Mar-a-Lago in December, according to the Wall Street Journal. Becoming president again has given Trump leverage to resolve his often frivolous lawsuits against big tech companies and large corporate-owned media outlets, and to walk away with multi-million dollar payouts. In one case, he has already wielded the weight of the Federal Communications Commission against a media company he's suing. ABC, owned by Disney, announced in December it would pay $15 million to resolve Trump's lawsuit over George Stephanopoulos' claim that Trump had been found liable for rape in civil lawsuits from E. Jean Carroll. Trump was actually found liable for sexual abuse. In late January, Meta agreed to pay $25 million to settle Trump's lawsuit over Facebook suspending his social media accounts after he fomented the January 6th riot. The Facebook and ABC payments went to Trump's new presidential library and museum slush fund. In the case of Trump's settlement with X, Musk didn't even bother with the library fund and instead negotiated a $10 million deal with Trump that will reportedly benefit the president personally. Trump has claimed he gave Musk a big discount. The $10 million deal with Trump might be smart for Musk after all, given that his relationship with the president has made him one of the world's most powerful people and put him in a position to profit off the government even more. Musk's Doge team has demanded sweeping access across the federal government to sensitive data and systems in order to enact firings, cancel projects, and cut off payments to entities that Trump and Musk don't like. The upshot for Musk is he now has access to an unparalleled trove of data about every American as well as his competitors. The opportunities for conflicts of interest are endless, given Musk's businesses. As Sierra Torres Spelsey, a law professor at the Stetson University College of Law, puts it, the number of potential conflicts of interest are legion. The Trump White House has argued that Musk can police his own activities and chose to excuse himself from Doge's work overseeing certain contracts or funding if he believes it poses a conflict. Musk, for his part, has suggested the public will hold him accountable regarding any conflict. People won't be shy about saying that, he said in a press conference with Trump. We would not let him do that segment or look in that area if we thought there was a lack of transparency or a conflict of interest, Trump volunteered before waving away any concerns. He's a successful guy. That's why we want him doing this. Trump later publicly added one potential restriction. Anything to do with possibly even space, we won't let Elon partake in that, he said. That would make sense, since Musk company SpaceX has received billions in contracts from NASA. When it was reported in February that the Trump administration was targeting NASA for a round of painful cuts, potentially 10% of the space agency's workforce, the agency was abruptly let off the hook. When hours of those reports emerging, NASA staff were told they could take a breath. At least for the moment, those cuts were postponed or maybe called off for good. The reason? Musk and his allies personally intervened to forestall the reported haircut, according to two sources with knowledge of the situation. As he tears through the federal workforce, Musk is cashing in on new and existing contracts, including with agencies that regulate his businesses. After Musk and Doge cut hundreds of jobs at the FAA, an agency that previously fined Musk SpaceX for regulatory and safety violations, news outlets reported the agency was preparing to hire Starlink, owned by SpaceX, to upgrade the system it uses to manage America's airspace. As Rolling Stone reported before anything was official, FAA officials quietly directed staff to find tens of millions of dollars to fund a Starlink deal. If Musk is in charge of hiring and firing workers at the FAA, then getting a no-bid FAA contract to provide services would be an epic conflict of interest, says Torres Spousey. If this is the case, then he is basically paying himself with taxpayer funds through a part of the government he partially controls through his ability to fire people. Talk of hiring Starlink has come up elsewhere. According to a source familiar with the matter, during the first few weeks of the second Trump era, Doge personnel reached out to officials at the FBI and Justice Department and asked if the Bureau had ever thought about adopting Starlink for sensitive operations and surveillance. I wanted to vomit, the source says, adding that there is no conceivable reason the FBI would need Starlink. The administration has also shielded Musk's X platform from potential oversight, pausing the work of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which polices big banks and other financial institutions, such as peer-to-peer payment apps. Musk is working with Visa to offer a peer-to-peer payment service called X Money Account. Other agencies scrutinizing Musk businesses have faced steep job cuts, including the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which has been investigating Tesla's self-driving technology. To the extent that Musk is hiring and firing people all over the U.S. executive branch, he is not in arm's-length transactions with government regulators, Torres Spilsey says. With respect to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, he would be both the regulator and the regulated. Since the dawn of his first administration, Trump has told his followers, promises made, promises kept. One 2024 vow he's kept was his pledge to make the federal government as autocratically MAGA and cultish as possible. During the present-day weekend in mid-February, Trump screamed the quiet part out loud, writing online, "He who saves this country does not violate any law." In paraphrasing an apparently fake Napoleon quote, Trump effectively declared that he thinks he can break any law he wants. In a more sane time, this sort of expression from the U.S. Commander-in-Chief would be a scandal. After all, the president is, due to the American Revolution, not a king. Trump and his staff soon doubled down, outright calling him the king. It would be easier to dismiss these words as mere trolling if Trump were not seeking to consolidate unchecked power. In his first month back in office, Trump moved to purge the FBI and Justice Department as vengeance for the criminal investigations he's faced. He's quickly turned the DOJ into a political arm of the White House and a protection racket for him, his friends, and allies, and a weapon against his enemies, real or perceived. Almost as soon as he was sworn in, multiple sources familiar with the matter tell Rolling Stone that there was a sudden, jarring information clampdown at the DOJ. Senior career officials at the Justice Department were suddenly cut out of daily conference calls and meetings to go over top-line threats or prime suspects that the feds were focusing on. Trump's political appointees repeatedly warned Justice Department career officials and attorneys that failure to comply with Trump's interpretation of the law, however legal it may sound, is grounds for removal. During the 2024 presidential campaign, Trump told several confidants that his new Justice Department would not be conducting any more, in his framing, illegal federal investigations of Trump's Republican pals. Already the president and his administration are following through on that. Ed Martin, Trump's new interim U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia, has publicly pledged to protect DOGE and described his team as President Trump's lawyers. More ominously, in February, his office reportedly declined to sign off on an arrest warrant for MAGA Florida Republican Corey Mills after he was accused of physically assaulting a 27-year-old woman. At the same time, Martin has publicly threatened to investigate Democratic lawmakers over their criticism of Musk and the conservative Supreme Court. After Trump took office again, the Justice Department's interest in corruption busting quickly evaporated, and the department announced it was ending its focus on foreign bribery and influence. The DOJ also moved to throw out its corruption case against New York Mayor Eric Adams so that he could more fully devote his attention and resources to assisting Trump's immigration crackdown. The ensuing scandal triggered a wave of resignations at the Department of Justice that included prosecutors who had clerked for staunchly conservative Supreme Court justices. In another presidency, it would have been the defining darkest episode. In Trump 2.0, it was another day, another week, another chance for the president and his people to practice their guiding Sopranos-style legal principle, which is simply, in the words of one conservative attorney close to Trump and his inner sanctum, "What are you going to do about it?" This concludes today's reading of the April 2025 edition of Rolling Stone. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.